What would President Hillary Clinton do today on the world? I'm Marco Werman. Tonight, Hillary Clinton is poised to accept the Democratic nomination in Philadelphia. But what would she do if elected president, for example, on immigration?
First of all, she has said she would favor a humane, targeted enforcement practice and would only focus on deporting those individuals who pose a violent threat to public safety.
That would be a change from President Obama's policy. Another change, Clinton's stance on Guantanamo.
Not only does she say that she wants to close it, she's got a pretty good track record so far of actually trying to get it done.
Plus, the line between courting the Latino vote and hispandering.
If they're saying that we're like one of you, that's when you're hispandering.
That's all coming up today here on The World. It is Hillary Clinton's turn. She takes center stage tonight at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. Polls show that she's still got some work to do in convincing many Americans to vote for her. We're going to spend a good part of today's show doing what we did last week with Donald Trump, asking how would a President Hillary Clinton address major foreign policy issues, from immigration to trade to China. But first, the perception of the former Secretary of State. Many voters here in the U.S. say they don't trust her, that she's dishonest. But Hillary Clinton's image overseas, especially among women leaders, is very much the opposite. Christina Asquith is director of our Across Women's Lives initiative. She's usually based in Istanbul, but today she's here with me in the studio. Why do women's rights champions overseas like Hillary Clinton so much, Christina?
Well, you know, Marco, it really goes back to the famous speech that she gave in Beijing at the UN Women's Conference in 1995, in which she declared women's rights are human rights, that famous one-liner that really sparked a global movement. And she interjected into the emerging human rights field this issue that women and their status and oppression of women needs to be a conversation and needs to be at the top of the agenda. So full disclosure, you know, in 1993, when I was 19 years old, before becoming a journalist, I was an intern in the Clinton White House. And I can, you know, distantly remember back then, even though I was just in the mailroom, how unusual it was to have a first lady talking about foreign policy and women's rights.
So how lively has that rhetoric been and her actual actions on these issues been since Beijing?
She talks about women and girls' rights really whenever she gets the chance. So that's heard from, you know, women across the world. She's famously a policy wonk. And when she came in as Secretary of State, she revamped the department. And it became quite well known that in her report on the changes that she wanted at State Department, women and girls were mentioned 130 times on a 40-page report. She also has, in all of her various trips around the world as Secretary of State, made a point of elevating voices of local women. When she goes to these countries, she meets with them. She insists that the delegation that she meets with have a woman present, and she gives space for those conversations about what these countries are doing on behalf of women and girls.
You know, Christina, critics would say that the outcome of many of Hillary Clinton's foreign policy decisions have been defined by hawkishness and that they have hurt women more than her advocacy has helped women. Prime example of that is the Iraq War, which she voted for when she was in the Senate, and which many say left women worse off after the invasion. Or we can cite the U.S. intervention in Libya, which she strongly advocated for. What is your take on that?
I think those are really legitimate criticisms. I lived in Baghdad for 2 years. I can certainly say that women are worse off now and that conflict always leaves women worse off. And I think her defenders would say, though, that, you know, as Secretary of State, she was steering a big ship with a lot of foreign policy objectives. She is not a women's rights advocate solely. So, you know, she's going to make decisions that are mistakes, perhaps, or even decisions that may leave women worse off. And that's really going to be a kind of a balance she's going to have to strike if she becomes commander in chief.
What about Saudi Arabia? It's a country with deeply oppressive laws restricting women's rights, and yet you don't hear Hillary Clinton speaking out for women there. Why do you think?
You know, her critics would certainly say that Saudi Arabia has us over kind of an oil barrel and that she's not willing to stand up to them because of the U.S.'s economic interests there. I think others would say, though, that, you know, when the U.S. has gone out barnstorming into the world, pushing forth these Western ideas of feminism and women's rights, it's had a really negative reaction. It sparked a backlash. And certainly you'd seen that when Bush administration officials famously came out in the early 2000s saying that Saudi Arabian women should have a right to drive. And you saw Saudi Arabian women kind of shouting her down, Karen Hughes, at a press conference, saying, you know, don't talk to us about what women's rights are. And so I think Hillary Clinton and other, you know, U.S. women leaders have learned from that lesson that they have to be sensitive and that it's much smarter to go out and offer a platform to local women to speak about how they see advancing their own rights in their own world than telling, or at least giving the appearance of telling women how they ought to live.
Christina Asquith, the director of our Across Women's Lives initiative and the founder of the Fuller Project for International Reporting. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Okay, let's move from perception to policy now. Hillary Clinton says that if she makes it to the White House, she'll introduce comprehensive immigration reform during her first 100 days in office.
Candidate Clinton has been very clear and made promises and pledged that she will stop the family detentions. And she's also said she would give lawyers, paid for by the government, for those who can't pay for them, to at least children who can't afford them and are seeking asylum here. Those are very important, clear pledges that she has made.
That's Greg Chen with the American Immigration Lawyers Association. He says Clinton has promised a dramatic break with Obama's policy towards immigrants, including families fleeing violence in Central America.
President Obama has really thrown the book at these asylum seekers coming here and enforced a very aggressive practice of detaining families, putting them into very rapid deportation policies and practices to get them out of the country. Candidate Clinton has said, as president, she would not do that.
Aren't you even a bit skeptical about that?
These family detention centers that we were talking about, which is two very large ones in Texas, have a very large capacity of over 2,000. But they were stood up in a very rapid pace in 2014 by President Obama. His practice of now detaining these families who are here, toddlers and infants with their mothers that are in detention facilities like jails, that is a tremendous change that he ushered in 2014. And it wasn't the previous practice. So it wouldn't be that difficult for President Clinton to change that and to stop using these kinds of jail-like facilities for families, because it wasn't the practice before.
President Obama has, since January, been relying on these pretty tough immigration raids, officers pounding on doors in immigrant communities at 4 or 5 in the morning, SWAT team style, people taken away in handcuffs. How quickly do you think a President Hillary Clinton would just stop that kind of thing?
She has pledged not to use raids against families and children and has said publicly that waking up mothers and children in their homes in the early hours of pre-dawn and taking them out of their houses with handcuffs is not a humane practice. And she has said she would stop that, and it would not be difficult for her to halt that.
Regardless of what Hillary Clinton decides to do if she becomes president, with the House of Representatives so firmly in Republican hands, isn't immigration reform any incremental change, just wishful thinking?
Immigration on the basic policy issues, there is not actually that much disagreement. Republicans and Democrats, there's a majority in both chambers that supports immigration reform and giving a path to legalization for those who are undocumented. So on those policy basics, there isn't that much disagreement. It's just a matter now of whether the Republican Party leadership wants to come to the table and work with a president that is willing to do it.
For many people hearing this story, it's about the challenges getting to fair immigration policy. But for you, it's very real, isn't it? I mean, these are real lives on the line.
What's most tragic is to hear a woman describe the kind of violence she has experienced in her home country. And they have to do these interviews before the judge over teleprompters often. And these women are appearing on these little tiny television screens with their children sitting right next to them, often a daughter or son who might be under the age of 5, who doesn't understand what's going on. And the mother is describing the most horrific kinds of violence, trying to explain what she experienced to this judge, who is maybe several hundred miles away, and explaining it in a foreign language and not understanding anything about our laws, and then saying, why am I being locked up in a jail here? I thought the United States protected asylum seekers. And you literally have these women who say, you know, we understand that there's a Statue of Liberty at our shores. Why are our borders protected in such a militarized way? And that just is heartbreaking to hear.
Greg Chen, Director of Advocacy for the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tim Kaine took the stage at the DNC last night as Hillary Clinton's running mate. And what are people talking about? His Spanish.
When I lived in Honduras, I learned something. The best compliment that you could pay to somebody was to say that they were listo, ready. Not inteligente, smart, but listo. It means prepared. It means rock solid, never backing down. And friends, Hillary Clinton, she's lista. Hillary Clinton is lista.
But reactions from the Latinx community have been mixed over the senator's use of Spanish. Robert Valencia is a journalist for Global Voices, and he's been listening to both campaigns closely in Spanish and English. So, Robert, what do you think? Is Hillary Clinton lista?
Well, she's definitely lista, not in the ready sense of the word, but I think she's very clever. She's very lista because she knows how important the Latino vote is, and that is going to be one of her strategies to defeat Trump. It's no secret that he has alienated the Latino community with his rhetoric. So definitely she is lista.
So regardless of how lista Secretary Clinton really is, I mean, reactions from the Latinx community over Tim Kaine's use of Spanish has brought out this term hispandering. It's been floating around the internet a lot this week. Remind us what hispandering means.
Hispandering is the portmanteau word of Hispanic and pandering, which, you know, in essence means we're just trying to lure your vote. But, you know, your issues are not really our issues per se. That would be the understanding of the word hispandering. For so many years, the Latino community has expected changes in legislation, particularly under immigration. So it is not enough to have someone speak Spanish, because what they want to see is those words translated into action.
Do you think Kaine is guilty of hispandering, or does he have a record of reaching out and connecting with Latinx voters?
Well, it does seem that he has a record. I mean, he was mostly appealing to a storytelling framework, telling his story about Honduras. Now, there is a blurry line when you bring stories like this. And Hillary Clinton is the perfect example of that when she was trying to compare herself to other Latino abuelas, Latino grandmothers, and how she's just like any other grandmother. And if you recall, a couple of months ago, there was this hashtag called Not My Abuela,
right.
Not My Grandma. So they had to be careful how they frame this sort of language or this sort of storytelling, because if they're saying that we're like one of you, that's when you're hispandering. That's when you are trying to toe in the line that you don't want to toe in.
Spanish was also featured at the Republican convention last week in Cleveland. There was Kentucky State Senator Ralph Alvarado who took the stage and spoke in Spanish. What was the difference in tone between the different conventions that you've noticed and their use of the language?
The rhetoric that you saw during the Republican Party is no different that we have seen in, you know, previous months. You had Donald Trump harping on the same topic. Immigrants, and specifically Mexicans, are bringing drugs. They are causing this mayhem in the United States, etc. You hear the same rhetoric over and over again. So you hear, for example, Latinos para Trump. You actually read the signs, and obviously that sounded like they want to appropriate, they wanted to buy Latinos. That's exactly how I read in Spanish, rather than say Latinos working with Trump, but it sounded like it was Latinos working for Trump. That's exactly how I read. So when you have those grammar faux pas in a campaign, obviously it's not going to fall well on Latinos' ears.
Yeah, got to get the preposition right, don't you?
Exactly. Language and grammar is important in every single language.
So 14 weeks ago, before the vote in November, should we expect to hear more Spanish on the campaign trail? And do you think this tactic's going to harm or help Hillary Clinton?
You will hear more Spanish, and that's because you know the importance of the Latino vote. If Latinos were a country in the United States, it'll be the 11th largest economy in the world.
Wow.
So you have this purchasing power that it cannot go unnoticed. And Latinos are becoming citizens by the hour. So you can be sure they're going to go to the polls and vote. Hopefully there will be a big turnout. But that is the power of the Latino vote, and it's going to be important come November.
Robert Valencia, journalist with Global Voices, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Does Kaine's ability to speak Spanish really matter that much? You can weigh in on our Global Nation Exchange. Just head over to Facebook and search for the Global Nation Exchange. You're with the world. Today we're focusing on some foreign policy issues that Hillary Clinton would face if she becomes president. So the detention camp at Guantanamo Bay. Both times Barack Obama ran for president, he campaigned to shut it down, but it's still open. And so another president will likely decide the camp's fate. Arun Roth is a colleague of mine here at WGBH. He's at Gitmo this week covering some big developments. Defense attorneys have accused the judge and prosecutor of destroying evidence of torture of detainees. Arun says the allegations pertain to a black site where some of the prisoners were held. And we should warn you, some of the descriptions that follow are graphic.
They decommissioned this place, which members of the defense have called a torture chamber. They removed what were called fixtures, contraptions or devices apparently involved in the torture. But in the bigger scheme of this trial, there's this big mountain of evidence which the defense is trying to get, which relates to their treatment in custody. And we're talking what are apparently 87 binders worth of information. The odd process is the prosecution goes through this first, kind of vets it and decides what they can release. They then submit that to the judge, who then reviews it. And then the judge gives it to the defense. We learned this week, almost in passing, that the judge mentioned this just in a few minutes earlier this week, that he's received about half of that material from the prosecution. And he said he's sending virtually all of it back to the prosecution for additions, basically indicating that they're not providing enough. And so, yeah, this process probably will still be taking a while.
Yeah, so if it takes a while, then it could very well end up with the next president of the United States. Let's take a look at a Clinton presidency. How would things differ at Gitmo under Hillary Clinton?
Well, we haven't heard Hillary Clinton talk about Guantanamo, the prison in Guantanamo, very much on the campaign trail. But she is on record saying that she does want to close the detention facility here. And it's also worth noting, Marco, that her record as Secretary of State does back that up. We saw that apparently the Secretary worked hard on prisoner transfers, getting personally involved in a case when she was trying to convince Germany to take a couple of these prisoners. And apparently, as Secretary of State, she heard from plenty of foreign leaders about the damage that the prison was doing for the U.S.'s standing in the world, its moral standing. And on her way out of office, she sent a memo to the president appealing to him again to finish the job of closing the prison. So not only does she say that she wants to close it, she's got a pretty good track record so far of actually trying to get it done.
We have heard Donald Trump's comments on Guantanamo. He says that he wants to fill it up with bad dudes. He wants to bring back waterboarding. And worse, that sounds like the opposite of Hillary Clinton. What would all that mean?
Well, you know, bad dudes, filling it up with more bad dudes, there would be space in the prison, certainly, and because of all the recent transfers. When he talks about bringing back waterboarding and worse, you know, I hate to be graphic, Marco, but I think we should know exactly the kind of stuff we're talking about, because it's not just waterboarding. Some of the details we've learned from the Senate report that came out a couple of years ago, these men were subjected to what they termed rectal rehydration or rectal feeding, which is just not a thing in modern medicine. And it was done as a means of control. So we're talking about sodomy, or as one of the lawyers said, rape. One of these men here, Mustafa al-Hawsawi, sits on a pillow in court because his rectum was damaged so severely, his lawyer says he still bleeds on a daily basis. When Donald Trump talks about, you know, bringing this back and worse, I'm not sure, you know, what worse would be compared to that.
So just to sum up, Arun, Donald Trump says he'd keep Gitmo open. Hillary Clinton says she'd close it.
Yeah, and couldn't be a more direct contrast than that.
WGBH's Arun Ross speaking with us from the 9/11 War Court in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Arun, thank you as always.
Marco, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Venezuela is also going to be a tricky one for the next president. U.S. relations with the oil-rich country are not good, and we get almost daily reports now about the collapse of Venezuela's economy. People there can't get basic necessities like food, diapers, and even toilet paper. But some relatives in the U.S. are trying to help their families back home. My WGBH colleague Philip Martin has a story of a man we see every day here at the station.
I often pass the security guards here at WGBH, and we stop and talk for a few minutes. That's the way it was with one of the guards here. I knew his name was Luis, but I did not know his story. But one night recently, he told it to me.
My full name is Luis Alfredo Valera Mendoza.
He's from Caracas, Venezuela.
The whole country is starving. These things are happening right now.
In Venezuela, there are severe shortages of food. Supermarket shelves are bare. Even though the country is rich in oil, people can't get the essentials. Luis Alfredo Valera Mendoza says he feels helpless to help the people who need him most, his two brothers, particularly his oldest brother, Gilberto.
My brother is diabetic, and at this point, the main medicine that he needs, the most important, is the insulin.
But in Caracas, insulin and other essential medicines can't be found. An estimated 80% of medication for chronic diseases have disappeared from pharmacies. The most critical shortages, according to NGOs, are contraceptives, anti-seizure and high blood pressure medications, anti-burn ointments, and insulin. Luis's brother's diabetes is made even worse by irregular meals that cause his blood sugar levels to spike.
My brother came to visit me this last Christmas, and he was already running out of insulin.
Gilberto might have been able to get insulin while he was here in Boston, but he does everything by the book, Luis says. And he did not have a prescription from a U.S. doctor. At the end of his visit here, Gilberto flew back to Venezuela without getting a supply of his medication.
So when he went back home and I found out that he cannot even get the doses anymore, then that's when I got scared. I talked to him last Sunday, and it broke my heart. It broke my heart because I'm trying to meet with him next Christmas. And he told me he doesn't think he's going to make it.
So Luis has arranged for friends living on the border with Colombia to buy insulin for Gilberto.
I've been trying to get insulin from the brother of a friend of mine that he lives in San Cristobal. The only way is through his brother. They send somebody across the border with Colombia, and they buy the medicine there now, and I'm hoping my brother will get it. He might get it, he might not, but I'm taking the chance because it's my brother's life.
Luis says Gilberto may not get the medicine because there are a lot of desperate people in Venezuela these days, and it could get stolen on the 16-hour drive from the border to Caracas.
Well, of course it is dangerous, but a lot of people cross the border. So, yeah, there's always a danger.
The danger extends to Caracas, which ranks as one of the most violent cities in the world. Its high crime disproportionately affects the poor and middle class. Wealthy areas can hire private security guards like Luis. He sees the irony.
Obviously, there must be some kind of security before you go across these areas, which in regular people like my family, we don't have the luxury to hire armed security forces in Caracas, only the wealthy people.
But Luis doesn't dwell on the chaotic politics of Venezuela. His main concern is his brother's health and the health of his country.
Every day that I eat, I thank God. But I also think about my brothers. And I'm sure they are going through a lot of hell. And the world needs to know what's going on. This is what's happening right now.
And with that, Luis continues his nighttime guard duties, checking doors and windows, turning off lights. For the World, Philip Martin, Boston.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, how would Hillary Clinton handle foreign policy as president? Well, she's no Obama.
In general, Hillary Clinton is going to be tougher on foreign policy than Barack Obama, whether it comes to Russia or China.
Also, how Clinton's position on trade has evolved over time. That's all ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Hillary Clinton, we can safely assume, will accept her nomination from the Democratic Party for president tonight. Last week, we asked how would Donald Trump handle major foreign policy challenges, so we're doing the same today for Clinton. And it's time to talk Russia. Prickly is one word for U.S.-Russian relations at the moment, especially after Russia was implicated in the DNC email hacking controversy earlier this week. Then came Donald Trump's appeal, sarcastic, he now says, to Russian hackers. Dmitry Sevastopoulos has been writing about U.S.-Russian relations for the Financial Times. I asked him what he thought Clinton's policy on Russia would look like.
I mean, in general, Hillary Clinton is going to be tougher on foreign policy than Barack Obama. Specifically, when it comes to Russia, if you think back in 2011, after the elections for the Duma, the Russian parliament, Hillary Clinton was very tough, basically suggesting that there had been electoral fraud in Russia. Mm. And that really angered the Russians. So the Russians are going to be very wary of her. And a lot will depend on what's happening in Russia at the time of the new American president coming into office.
What was Hillary Clinton's relations with Russia like when she was Secretary of State? Did she negotiate head-to-head with Russian officials?
She did go to Moscow several times during her tenure as Secretary of State. She negotiated with the Foreign Minister Lavrov. So she did talk to the Russians, but they viewed her as a kind of a hawk and someone that they were wary of. So the relationship was seen in that context.
Dmitry, I keep having this image from the series House of Cards in which First Lady Claire Underwood, who is also UN ambassador, she has to confront the Russian president and he bullies her. Is that how it's going to go if Clinton is president and tries to deal with Putin?
There could be an element of that. I mean, you know, Putin is a strong man. I think he will try on the strong arm tactics in the beginning if it is Hillary Clinton in the White House. But she's not a pushover. And I suspect Hillary Clinton will push back very hard. And she's not going to be a pushover for Vladimir Putin. I think everyone would agree on that.
So handicap for us just the U.S.-Russia challenges that are on your short list for the next president.
Top of the list is probably Ukraine, where you have a very shaky ceasefire at the moment that continues to be violated on a daily basis. You have the question of whether America provides arms to the Ukrainian rebels. Now, that's something that Hillary Clinton was more in favor of doing, where Barack Obama was resistant. And Syria is always going to be a huge issue. How the Americans deal with the Russians in trying to deal with Assad in Syria, I think is pretty much going to be right at the top of the list.
Yeah, and then what happens if that guy Snowden decides to leave?
Well, the question for Snowden is, if he decides to leave, is where does he go? And I haven't heard Hillary Clinton talk specifically about what she would do with Snowden, but I think it's hard to believe that they would provide amnesty for him. So we'd have to see who would actually take Snowden in, and then if that happens, how that affects U.S. relations with the country that takes him.
How does it feel talking about Russia when, you know, foreign policy has really not cracked the sky too much there at the convention?
One of the amazing things about this campaign is that even where foreign policy has become an issue on television, you know, with the pundits, it really is not playing out in the American heartland, whether it's in Philadelphia at the convention, Cleveland last week at the Republican convention. And one of the interesting things is when Donald Trump this week, you know, suggested to Russia that they hack into U.S. email servers and try and find Hillary Clinton's emails, you know, the foreign policy elite, Democrats and Republicans alike, were livid. They thought this was bordering on treason. But when you're out in Indiana or Michigan or Kansas talking to voters, they don't care. And in some ways, the more the foreign policy elite attack Donald Trump, the more they like him, because it just reinforces this divide that exists between kind of the elites in Washington and the rest of the country.
So do you think Hillary Clinton is going to try and address that heartland audience tonight?
I think Hillary Clinton is going to try and speak to Americans and convince them that she is trustworthy, because that is really her biggest issue in this election. And that's a point that Donald Trump is hammering on day after day after day. So she needs to tackle that. And really, no one at the convention so far has addressed that head on.
Dmitry Sevastopoulos, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Let's turn now to the topic of trade and how Hillary Clinton sees that. The World's Jason Margolis is joining me here in the studio. We talked about Donald Trump on trade last week, and just a quick recap on his position. Basically opposed to trade deals. He's promised to dump a NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. He's also opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which you reported on the other day on the show, Jason. So what is Clinton's plan on trade, and how is it different from Trump's?
Okay, well, let's start with NAFTA. And just to refresh your memory, that was signed into law in 1994. It was negotiated by the first President Bush, signed into law by President Bill Clinton. Now, the vast majority of economists will tell you NAFTA has benefited the U.S. economy. But, you know, try telling that to auto workers in Ypsilanti, Michigan, right?
Yeah.
The popular sentiment is NAFTA was a bad thing. So Hillary, she's in a tough spot. Bill Clinton signed it. She championed it. Then in 2008, she's running for president against Barack Obama. And he uses this against her very shrewdly. Let's listen to candidate Obama 8 years ago.
It is absolutely true that NAFTA was a mistake. I know that, you know, Hillary on occasion has said that this was just last year, said this was a boon to the economy. I think it has been devastating.
So Obama campaigned hard on this issue, really backed her into a corner. As a candidate, Hillary Clinton said NAFTA was flawed and everyone said she was a flip-flopper. Big political points for Obama.
Yeah, but Obama himself, I mean, he championed a trade deal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Was he just using NAFTA to push back against Hillary in 2008?
Right. So that's very interesting. So Obama said he was going to amend NAFTA. He never did. And there's a host of reasons why he didn't. He said it wasn't the right time. Some people said he went back on his promise. So now he's championing the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Mm-hmm. And that's basically an expansion of NAFTA. It's a trade deal with 12 nations, the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, and 9 other Asia-Pacific nations. So Bernie Sanders backers hate the TPP, and you see lots of signs in Philadelphia with the TPP crossed out. Actually, during President Obama's speech last night, I don't know if you heard it, a heckler shouted, "No TPP,"
right,
a few times. and Donald Trump opposes it as well. Now, Hillary Clinton, she's a shrewd politician. NAFTA was used against her 8 years ago. So very early on, last October, she comes out. She says, I may have supported TPP when I was Secretary of State, but I supported it in principle. The final document, it's not up to my standards. Here she is on the PBS NewsHour last fall.
Well, I have said from the very beginning that we had to have a trade agreement that would create good American jobs, raise wages, and advance our national security. And I still believe that's the high bar we have to meet.
So she says the TPP doesn't currently meet that high bar. She'd like to avoid the subject as much as possible, though, for the next few months.
Is Hillary Clinton flip-flopping on her position on trade deals?
Is it a flip-flop? Is she playing politics, or did her positions evolve? Depends on who you ask. Pretty sure Donald Trump is going to use this pretty strongly against her.
So if Hillary Clinton is elected as president, do you think she'll sign the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
First of all, it's possible that Barack Obama will sign it in the next few months, so it's a moot issue. But if Hillary Clinton is elected president, well, yesterday, Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, who's a longtime Clinton family friend, he told the website Politico that she will pass it and make some fixes. A Clinton aide pounced on that comment and said, no, Hillary opposes the TPP before and after the election. No ambiguity there. But some economists I've spoken with think she'll find a way to pass it and make some fixes. We'll see what happens.
So do you think she'll even mention the TPP tonight in Philadelphia?
If I were a betting man, I would say there is about a 0.00% chance of that.
That's pretty low. World's Jason Margolis, thanks very much for filling us in.
You're welcome.
If you want to compare Trump and Clinton on trade and other big foreign policy issues, head over to our Facebook page. It's easy to find us. Just look for The World on Facebook. Now, China. The Chinese are watching both conventions closely, but not for the reasons you might think. Jiaqie Tang is in Philadelphia helping to cover the Democratic convention for Sina News, a private Chinese media company.
Well, for my audience, it's more like watching a show, you know, like watching American's election. And we have three colleagues coming from Beijing to cover it with me, and we are all very surprised to see such a big party and such a big chaos at the same time.
You call it a party of the Congress that they have every so often in China, the Communist Party Congress. That, I gather, is not much of a party, but there are a lot of people there, right?
Yeah, that's totally different. You don't expect to see singer, NBA player, music, and like a big festival in China during the convention. But well, you see in America, the convention is like bringing the whole countries, Republican or Democrat, together and celebrating.
Now, I know it's hard to generalize about 1.5 billion people, but what do the Chinese make of Hillary Clinton? What are you hearing from your viewers?
Oh, it's actually very interesting. I found there's more negative view from Chinese audience toward Hillary than Trump. And I feel like they got the impression for Hillary since, you know, when she was the first lady and then when she had delivered the speech, Woman Right is Human Rights in Beijing, and then the Secretary of State, where she has the Pivot Asia policy, the Asian rebalance, and her strong view on South China Sea. Chinese people don't enjoy foreign leader to finger point their issues domestically, you know. And on the other hand, when Chinese people think of Trump, they remember his reality show, The Apprentice, and they remember he's a businessman, he's Trump Tower in Manhattan, and also his funny quotes, which you won't expect from a politician in America or even all over the world. And the audience in China seems to like it. And it's fun to watch what Trump is saying, what he's doing. And, you know, Chinese people like to deal with businessmen instead of lawyer, which is Hillary is more like a lawyer type of president if she got elected.
Yeah, but do they think a President Donald Trump would go any easier on the South China Sea? Do you think President Trump would actually let China continue?
That's the interesting part. I think people don't know what Trump is thinking. He's unpredictable. And when covering this, we, as foreign media, we don't have any Trump people talking about foreign policy to us. While in this time in DNC, Hillary's foreign policy advisor actually have several briefings to foreign media. And The funny part is I feel like I'm listening to the White House briefing or the State Department briefing because it's very consistent to what Obama's administration was doing.
Right. So given all that negative impression, what would a Hillary Clinton presidency mean for China?
I believe she will be very consistent on following Obama administration's Asian policy or Chinese foreign policy, even on human rights issue, on South China's the issue, on TPP. However, she might be stronger than what Obama is doing right now.
Jiaqi Tang is the D.C. bureau chief for Sina News. She's in Philadelphia covering the DNC. The World's Leo Hornack is there, too. And yesterday he got to meet a Democratic Party heavy hitter, Jesse Jackson.
It was incredibly exciting, of course. I mean, this is someone that I've grown up seeing on the TV and I remember hearing as a very young kid. But I discovered that getting an interview with Jesse Jackson is not like any other political figure. You don't make an appointment, at least at these conventions, you don't make an appointment at an agreed place and time. What happens is he makes a kind of slow progress at certain times through bits of the convention. And if you're standing in the right place, like on a higher level, you can see this kind of feeding frenzy happening as like smaller fish, reporters with cameras kind of dart in, ask a question, and then get kind of shooed away again as he slowly moves through. And I was one of those tiny fish darting in. And luckily, perhaps, I don't know through the BBC name, we don't know, he was kind enough to give me a slightly longer interview than many of the other people.
So what did you talk about?
The key thing I wanted to find out from him is what he thought a Trump presidency would mean for African Americans. And the answer that he gave to me was surprisingly specific. He said that historical black colleges, affirmative action, and Medicaid are all going to suffer, and they're under threat from Trump, and that they're only safe with Hillary. That was the quote he gave me. They're only safe with Hillary.
Yeah, what was his evidence that that would be the case?
Well, he didn't. I mean, again, with Jesse Jackson, perhaps it's not the kind of interview where if you ask for sources or evidence, he speaks in a rolling rhetorical style. He declaims. So when I pressed him on that, he essentially avoided the question and said, oh, they're very interesting things, but he just carried on. But there was something that I did draw from that. And what it reminded me of was the contrast with the other African-American activists and Black Lives Matter activists that I've been speaking to during both these conventions. And it was such a contrasting answer, Marco. The idea that the essential interests of Black America are only safe with Hillary was in diametrical opposition with what these other campaigners, a younger generation of campaigners, have been telling me. And both Black Lives Matter at the Republicans and the Black Men for Bernie campaign had both told me that they feel that this attitude has held their community back. The idea that they're only safe with the Democrats has allowed the Democrats to take this community for granted.
Who is the Jesse Jackson of the UK, like the man or woman who, you know, looks at their world and says, hey, these policies will help my community? Who's been doing that for decades there?
Well, I mean, I don't think there is a Jesse Jackson. There is only one Jesse Jackson. But in London, we recently elected Sadiq Khan, the first Muslim South Asian mayor of London. And I think he may go on to have the same kind of iconic status.
Our own Leo Hornack in Philadelphia, reporting all week from the Democratic National Convention. Leo, thanks for your time, as always.
Thanks very much, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We've had Mexican musician Camilo Lara on the show before. It's been a while, though, because the dude is a busy guy. He's written music for TV shows like Breaking Bad, Scrubs, and Entourage. He's also written tracks for video games like Grand Theft Auto V and for movies. Y Tu Mama Tambien is one. And if that's not enough, Camilo was also president of a major record label, EMI Mexico, the whole time focused on his own one-man remixing act, Mexican Institute of Sound, MIS. But this time, MIS has reached out to collaborate with over 90 musicians and artist friends from around the world, just for one album called Compass, a giant fusion of street music, rock, cumbia, mambo, and hip-hop. Lara and I spoke about what he and producer Toy Selecta managed to cook up.
Toy and I share a lot of common ground together. We believe in cumbia, so we always thought that cumbia and all the street rhythms could live in a dance floor. So we decide to do this experiment, like what if we put like a lot of different rhythms in the same dance floor, punk rock, hip hop, electronica, cumbia. So we decided to do this globetrotting project and travel around the world recording with people that we admire or friend of us, and that is Compass. And it's funny because Compass in Spanish means compadres, but in English it's a compass, and it show you the way to go, no? Shout out to your father, shout out to your mama, shout out to Dalai Lama, Jay Electronia, put it behind ya, you know what we got, bro.
Whipping in a Nissan Elantra, up in Atlanta. The lineup is so global and diverse. You've got Toots Hibbert from Toots and the Maytals, Jamaica, of course. There's actor Gael Garcia Bernal, Japanese DJ and producer Cornelius Eugene Hoots from Google Bordello here in the U.S., Das Racist, Bonji Dahole from Brazil. Did you go to all these places?
We traveled to each city. We did recordings in Brazil, in the U.S., in England, and we did some recording in India, in China. And even though this is an album, it's also a documentary that is going to be soon on the web. And it's kind of it is more than just making an album. Everyone getting crazy conscious. I think it's beautiful because now in these days that everything is made through email or through online collaboration, it's beautiful to just see each other and share ideas and to have like this kind of experience. And that is the project about. It's about collaboration. He can do it the hard way, but she's going to do it my way.
Everyone getting crazy conscious. So there's this track called Before the Sunset. Let's hear a bit of that. Te conheço como a palma da minha língua, como a face dos meus dentes, igual quando você rasga minha pele, mas não sente, mas não sente. Amor. Ai, amor. Aqui estou. Devo deixar-te. Te llevo a tu secretária. Ai, amor. Aqui estou. Tears fall. This is a track called Before the Sunset. It features Stella Campos on vocals. It also features actor Gael Garcia Bernal. I know he's starring in the series Mozart in the Jungle, so he's immersed in music there. Here he's mostly reciting, but he's got to do that to time, right? What are his musical chops?
Well, I know Gael for a long time. We worked together in Y Tu Mamá También a long time ago.
The movie, yeah. Great movie.
Yeah, and also I did a track with him for a movie called Rudo y Cursi. So I knew he could sing, and I always thought Gael is this kind of a magnetic personality and character, such as Gainsbourg, and that probably...
Serge Gainsbourg from France, yeah.
Exactly.
Very similar, yeah. I see that.
So I thought it would be beautiful to put him on the character of Gainsbourg and to make this track. And this is the result. And I think it's amazing. Since he's a great actor, his delivery as singer is great. Ela quando foi nem fez pensar, se perdeu, foi sorte, foi sorte.
The single that's come from the album, Canta Sin Medo, what does that mean?
It's Sing Without Fear in Portuguese. We were spending time at at the studios in Sao Paulo, and we found out about this couple of women called Mercurias and Lourdes Daluz, an amazing, very powerful duet. And we have an amazing Afrobeat band called Bixiga 70, which is mind-blowing. So I think that track is probably like a great Polaroid picture of what we did in Brazil.
Well, the title, Sing Without Fear. Is this a nod to the country that everyone's going to be focused on in August?
Well, it's going to be very interesting to see how Brazil behaves.
Well, I've got this image of all the broadcasts playing Mas Que Nada by Sergio Mendes, you know, for all the continuity. But I think, actually, Canta Sin Medo ought to be the subversive theme of the Olympics.
Yeah, and the amount of artists we collaborate is just the tip of the iceberg of such a crazy, unbelievable diversity on musicians.
Camilo Lara in Mexico City, otherwise known as Mexican Institute of Sound, who along with DJ and producer Toy Selecta produced Compass. It's out later in August. We've got the single here. Camilo, thank you very much for the interview, and thank you very much for a great summer jam.
Thank you so much, Marco, and it's a pleasure to be with you.
Camilo M.I.S. Lara there on the Brazil tip, talking about his global recording party with almost 90 artist friends on an album called Compass. We've got more Brazil music for you on tomorrow's show. You'll want to be back for that. That'll do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.